Blog Talk Radio. Greetings, this is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Sunday, March 17th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast. Later on, we'll be continuing our focus on International Women's History Month. We have a special focus on Ella Baker, the legendary civil rights and human rights organizer who had participated in organizing drives by the NAACP as early as the 1930s, then, of course, becoming the first executive secretary of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference during the late 1950s, and, of course, playing an instrumental role in the founding and the initial organizing work of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee during the 1960s. Later, we'll look at Fannie Lou Hamer, from Mississippi, where she had joined the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and voter registration drives. Later, a co-founder of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, a powerful orator and a pioneer in regard to the struggle for civil rights and human rights in the United States and indeed internationally. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. We'll take our musical interlude with the South African songstress, Leta Umbulu. This is released in 1970. Let's listen in.
me feed all the things I know. Oh,
Welcome back, and that is the voice of the legendary Leta Mbulu from the Republic of South Africa, a jazz singer. And of course, Leta Mbulu was raised in the southwest townships of South Africa. She has been active as a singer since the 1960s. While she was a teenager, she toured with the musical King Kong. She left for the United States in 1964 due to the racist apartheid system that was prevalent at that time in the Republic of South Africa. In New York City, she connected with other South African exiles, including Miriam Makeba, Hugh Masekela, Jonas Gwangwa, and went on to work with Cannonball Adderley, David Axelrod, and Harry Belafonte. On screen, her singing can also be heard in the TV documentary Roots, The Color Purple, the movie, the original from 1985, and in the 1973 film, A Warm December, and she was co-starred there with Sidney Poitier. She was a guest on season 6 episode of Soul Train. Mbulu also provided a Kiswahili chant in Michael Jackson's single, Liberian Girl. Producer Quincy Jones has said of her, quote, Mbulu is the roots lady, projecting a sophistication and warmth which stirs hope for attaining pure love, beauty, and unity in the world. She is the founding member of the South African Artists United, an organization that was established in 1986. Mbulu is married to musician Kapus Semenya. As the apartheid regime loomed over the people of color in the 1960s, Mbulu went to the United States, where in exile, she continued to pursue her musical career. She toured with jazz alto saxophonist Cannonball Adderley and also went on to join forces with the African-American singer Harry Belafonte. Together, they went on several world tours. Her main musical influences became folk, American jazz, and Brazilian music. And that was a brief background on the contributions of South African singer Leta Mbulu. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of our program for this week. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for this Sunday, March the 17th, and we're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. My name is Abayomi Azikiwe. I am the host of this program. Marsha Hunt, doing the track entitled Black Flower. And this is International Women's History Month, and we're going to feature a interview, rare archival audio file with Ella Baker, one of the unsung heroes of the civil rights and human rights movement in the United States. These interviews were conducted in 1974. Let's listen in.
And you listen. And the motivation behind it being founded to really get at it. And if we were to look at, say, the Bolshevik revolution in Russia, and this is what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to contrast the movement here with other movements. And you know that that movement was rooted very deeply in ideological kinds of considerations. I'm searching for ideology in this movement, but it's so elusive until I'm going to have to conclude, I believe, that there was no basic ideology involved in the founding of SCLC, not really the NAACP, unless you don't call the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States an ideology, you know, because they don't really put out pamphlets, write conceptual frameworks, which is styles and ideology dealing with the system per se. They come up with tactics and programs to deal with problems dealing with race relations, you know. And I'm trying to really examine it. It's not so unclear in my mind, as you can see, but these are the kinds of things that I'm trying to look at here.
No, I don't think there was an ideology that certainly was comparable to the Marxist-Leninist concept of a changed society. The nearest to an ideology would be, let's call it the Christian philosophy, and that tied in with the a philosophy of Gandhian nonviolence, mass action, nonviolent mass action. That was the nearest to it. But you see, this in itself becomes an elusive sort of a thing when the, let's call it the impact of the need to grow enters in. And maybe the influence upon individuals, the individual leadership as to what shall we do next. And the what shall we do next frequently comes from suggestions from sources other than the organization, like the identification with or speaking out against the identification with the anti-war movement. This did not develop out of the organization, out of discussion within the organization. It no doubt came as a suggestion to the president and the invitation to the president to come and speak at the anti-war rally. And I know something about somebody saying there's a time now for Martin to speak on anti-war. Do you think that this is the time for it? And somebody would say, yes, it is. And somebody would talk to him, somebody that he felt duty-bound, let's call it, to listen to.
Okay. So the character then, and I'm trying to just theorize here and just give almost every kind of responses,
yeah.
And I want your reaction to them. The character here then, as I said, would be more on an action-oriented kind of a movement than one which would lend itself to a somewhat long-term plan or an ideology based on bringing about permanent social change or change in the system as such. And this action-oriented movement lent itself more to spontaneity than it did to the development of a structure which would require a kind of rigid format down through the years. So this, I think, more than anything else, would reflect on the ultimate character that was inherent in what SCIC was doing. Or would you differ with that?
No, I wouldn't differ with it. I think you're quite correct there, because the personnel who provided the leadership for this for SCLC had never come to grips with a philosophical concept other than the general concept of nonviolent mass action. Now, I don't think there was much, I'll be gracious and say, either time or other bases for in-depth thinking about how far nonviolent mass action can.
I want to acknowledge, first of all, that most of the literature I've read, they've spoken rather highly of you. Some have gone so far as to dedicate works to you. Howard Zinn and his black abolitionist, Leon Hope, his work on Mississippi Freedom Summer. These men felt that you were one of the main causes of the squeal that these subsequent movements fought on. So I'm honored to talk to you this morning, and I'd like for you to share with me some of your experiences and accounts of the role you played in SCLC and your interpretations of roles other individuals played in the organization that you might deem necessary to give me more insight as to the dynamics involved and the programs that SCLC ultimately initiated. So my first question to you, as I was saying earlier, is can you mention to me or point out to me other factors aside from the Montgomery movement and, say, the 1954 Supreme Court decision, which may have contributed to the founding of SCLC when it was founded in 57?
Well, I think what you have is a question of continuity of struggle. You said that people had referred to me largely in terms of maybe being a factor. And that, I think, sprang from the fact that in, say, several years before that, a number of years before that, in the 40s, in the late 30s, and in the 40s, but the 40s in particular, I was working with the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and a primary function of mine was to go into areas, maybe some of the areas that had not been visited in a long while. For instance, I used to leave New York sometime in February and go into Florida. I'd start at the beach of St. Pete's Tampa. And that was because we did not have, the association didn't have an active branch in Miami at the time. And so you'd work around St. Pete's Tampa and up the east or the west coast, the Palm Beach, West Palm Beach, and on and up. Pompano, small places, and hit Jacksonville, from Jacksonville to Tallahassee to Pensacola, Pensacola into Georgia, into Mobile, through Alabama, Alabama into Georgia, Georgia up until you came into Virginia. So that had been my itinerary for several years, and in the process it was not to be unthought of that I had touched a number of people who had not been visited for a long time by association personnel. So that may account for the whatever historical impact I may have had. In addition to that, the 54 decision was frequently interpreted by people as being the end of the struggle, because the NAACP's struggle had been one of legal action to a large extent, and the 1954 decision culminated a effort on the part of the lawyers of the association to raise the question of the constitutionality of racial segregation. And this was the case on which that got verbalization. And so that becomes a historical monument. And to some people, it almost was interpreted as being the end of the struggle. But as we have seen from the history of the question of racial segregation and discrimination, we have had court action that has been nullified from time immemorial. You must go back to the Reconstruction period, and I'm not going into that, but you go back there. Much of what was supposedly gained in the 40s and 50s legally had been supposedly secured to us in right after the Reconstruction period. And you know those laws were nullified. So, SCLC, why? It was...
You were about to speak to the why of SCLC.
Well,
your point on.
I think the basic why of SCLC has to do with what had taken place in the 54 decision, and the unthought of Montgomery bus boycott. But before you can evaluate the bus boycott, you have to understand how it came about. And it didn't come out of a vacuum. There were two people in Montgomery who had functioned with the NAACP over the years, and they were Mrs. Rosa Parks and Ed E. D. Nixon. Not Ed. I don't know what his name was, but E. D. Nixon. Where did E. D. Nixon get his fire? He got his fire, his sense of social action, from being a member of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and the struggle that it had waged over the years. And so when the Montgomery bus boycott, let's call it,
ended successfully. Here you had a social phenomenon that had not taken place in the history of those of us who were around at that time, where hundreds of people and even thousands of people, just ordinary people, had taken a position that put them in a very uncomfortable, at least made life less comfortable for them, when they decided to walk rather than to ride the bus. And this was a mass action, and a mass action that anybody who looked at the social scene would have to appreciate and wonder, those of us who believe that mass, only through mass action are we going to eliminate certain things, would have to think in terms of how does this get carried on? And so whatever the reasons or however the historical accidents of history or whatever else that precipitated Martin as the president, and that's quite a story. I'm not going into it because you didn't come here for that. But whatever those factors were, he was there as the spokesman for the boycott. And out of the boycott, he became a worldwide known individual, articulating the strivings and the hopes and so forth of the people who were involved in the boycott.
At this time, you were working with the NAACP.
No, at 54?
No, at 57.
No. See, I left the NAACP nationally in 46. And then I served, I worked with the local branch, and I think I was the president in the 50s, somewhere in the 50s. In 1957, at the time that SCLC was formally organized, I think that's when it was formally organized, I was doing a program that of trying to educate or trying to stimulate action on the part of Black and Puerto Rican parents in respect to the food situation. See, the New York City had taken, had set up a commission, or the Commission on De Facto Segregation, I believe. I'm not sure, but they were supposed to be eliminating de facto segregation in the food system of New York. And so for the summer of 57, we had weekly meetings with parents in the different boroughs for getting them to deal with the question of their schools, what is happening to their children. And that's where Kenneth Clark came into the picture on the whole area of...
I'd like to back up a second. You mentioned the fact that E.D. Nixon probably got a lot of his fire from his early affiliation with Sleepy Car Holders, and Ms. Rosa Parks had been an NAACP member for a long time. But I also read an account as to where Ms. Parks had attended earlier the Highland of Hope School. This was a place in Montego, Tennessee, as you know, where people would go, you know, aspiring to be leaders in the community, to get different kinds of training as to how did they best go about doing it. And it was right after that that Ms. Parks decided that she wasn't going to give up her seat. So it's a question over here as to where her primary motivation came from as to the reason she didn't give up her seat. Have you heard that story before about the Montego influence?
Sure. Well, the first time Mrs. Parks left Montgomery to go anywhere, she says, I don't know, was to come to Atlanta to a regional leadership training conference that I happen to have organized. When I was precipitated into the directorship of branches of the NAACP, one of the first things I projected was the ideas, the need for training of the people who were carrying on ranch activity. And when I said training, largely in terms of preparing the, giving them the information and then broadening the scope of their understanding of what was involved. One of the reasons was that I had seen that many, to a large extent, most of the branches were feeling that their duty was to provide some memberships and some money to the national army. They had attitudes that were not particularly helpful in terms of change. For instance, say Atlanta or somewhere else. I'm not identifying Atlanta per se as such, but they would be against the idea of going to battle for the town group who happened to have been maybe brutalized and being arrested. Because who was he? And in some places like Buffalo, New York, for instance, most of the black children were coming out with high school with just certificates attesting to the fact that they had been in attendance. I frequently would have people ask me as I came up from the deep south, up say to Virginia, North Carolina, how are things down south? Which meant that to them, that's where the problem was, and they had not identified the problem in their own area. So,
this is in what, the '50s, the early 50s?
The '50s, yes. Late 40s, see the 40s, up to 46, 47, when I was trapped.
Now you said that you worked at, you did some social work in the in Florida, came up to Mobile, and,
that was in the 40s.
In the 40s. You threw that on your own.
With the NAACP. I was serving as an assistant field secretary there.
How was it that you moved into a position at STLC? What was the process involved?
The process there was, after the 54 decision, after the Montgomery boycott, or simultaneous almost with it. The 54 decision precipitated certain kinds of repressive action against people who attempted to enroll their children in school. Two places in particular come to mind. One was Clarendon County, South Carolina. And I think that was Yazoo, Mississippi, where the black parents attempted to enroll. And certain repressive actions were taken against people who were tenant farmers for 30 and 40 years, no longer had anywhere to farm. And those who had no business, they were boycotted, were boycotts against them in terms of the delivery of goods and services. So some of us here in New York, including two or three ministers, one in particular, one black minister who's now dead, that was Jim Robinson, the Reverend James H. Robinson, who was in the Presbyterian Church, the Church of the Master, and he had been associated with the NAACP as a youth secretary. And Rabbi Wise, I believe it was. I have the list here, but these. They were people who were at Prestige, but some of the rest of us, like Byers, George Lawrence, Stanley Levison of the American Jewish Committee, and so forth, organized what was, and some of the labor people organized what was called In Friendship, and its purpose was largely to provide some material and legal assistance as much as possible to such people as were being evicted from their households and other situations in Clarendon County and Yazoo and other places. So out of that came the concept of an enlarged effort. You see, now by that time you were running into, so 54 was the decision. The people were having their difficulties, say 55 and 56, and then came in that period, you see, the Montgomery boycott took place. And the boycott then moved on the scene as having involved a large number of people. And so the question arises, where do you go from here? Also, the question arose in respect to mass action. Does the NAACP lend itself to mass action? Or will it initiate mass action? Or will it continue its program of legalism? And so some...
Yes, it would come at that period.
So the question in some of our minds is that there was something there that should continue, that you needed a force in the South that was comparable to the NAACP in some respect. Why? Because the NAACP, in the minds of those of us who were concerned at that stage, primarily dealt with legal action. And although it had a program of branch action, it had not organized mass action that lent itself to demonstrations, etc. If you think in terms of something in the South for mass action, and then you start with the group that had been involved in something. So there was Montgomery. And in connection with Montgomery, there were large numbers of black ministers, or a number of black ministers throughout the area, who had identified with that struggle. For instance, C.K. Steele in Tallahassee, Florida, and Abraham was something or other in New Orleans.
Yeah, Jameson.
And Jameson had had a boycott of his own in Baton Rouge, you see. So what you do then is stimulate the thought of an organization in the South that can spread the...
At this point, you may be able to help me clear up another question, too. There's a question as to where the initial call for this conference came from. Reading a book like Lewis Miller, they suggest that the call came from C.K. Steele. Well, I went down and interviewed Reverend Steele, and he assured me that the call didn't come from him. He responded to the call. Some Jewish talking or some funny talking man called him. He's always thought it was Bear Rustin, and asked him if he would go along with the conference in late December 56. And he said, yeah, it was just this kind of a thing. He had just finished this Tallahassee thing, and they were with that Ever Civic Council. So I'm trying to pin down if it's any way possible.
I don't know whether you can pin it down other, because now I think Byatt may not to verify the fact that there were three of us who talked into the wee hours of the morning in terms of how do you develop a force that can enlarge upon the gains or the impact of the Montgomery Force of boycott.
Did the three represent you, Byatt, Levinson?
Stanley Levinson. Largely at Stanley's house. He was a man with some money, and Byatt and I would go over there. Not living where he used to. Why me? Because I knew the South, comparatively, in terms of their knowledge of it. They had not had as wide knowledge as I had. Plus the fact I had been associated with the NAACP. And so we talked into the wee hours and the concept of trying to develop out of the Montgomery Boycott leadership a force. And when they approached, no doubt, Martin and whoever else, it was largely their response would be in terms of ministry. That's why you get the ministerial thing. You couldn't think in terms of a leadership out around a boycott without also thinking of C.K. Steele's effort and Jameson's effort.
McCullough, South Carolina.
Well, McCullough
came
a little bit after that. But you see, then when you go into the whole question of which was the pattern in the South, who are the leaders, the ministers, which may or may not be justifiable, but that's how it started. And so then, let's say the call came from Martin.
Yeah, well, that's where the basic report.
Yeah, but they thought, historically, he gets credit for it, but the truth, let it be known that no one individual really conceives of an idea like that without somehow, some other thing, some other input.
Right. Now, I can see a great deal of participating happening, leading to the founding of SCLC. The next question in my mind is, after this was realized, that there was a need for somewhat of an instrument to try and spread this movement that was in Montgomery, with the hope of bringing about greater social change. What was the notion of the kind of an organization you would have? I know you said you would have a great deal of ministers, but would it be one with just the president and a lot of lieutenants, a president and executive secretary with a great deal of power? Was it a democratic organization in conception, a strong dictatorial organization? What was the thinking about the nature of the organization at this time?
Well, the thinking about the nature of the organization would vary with the people who were doing the thinking. Those of us who preferred an organization that was democratic and where the decision-making was left with the people would think in one vein. And the organizing of active, let's call it, chapters or units of people. But when you reckon with the fact that the majority of the people who were called together were ministers, and the decision as to who was called together emanated, no doubt, from both the background out of which, let's call it, Martin and Knowles came, and maybe lack of understanding, I'm willing to grant, of the virtue of utilizing the mass surge that had developed there in Montgomery. Just look at Montgomery. What has happened since in Montgomery? What?
That's right, nothing. But there's another problem here.
So I think that came, the nature of the organization became to a large extent a ministerial thing. Out of the 100 plus, I forgot how many, that were present at that initial meeting where the formal organization took place. I think Whitney Young and a guy from Mississippi whom I had worked with for a number of years, I can't think of his name. No. Amson Moore in Cleveland, Mississippi. Were among the maybe two or three non-ministers present. And I was the only woman. I think maybe another person came and sat in with them.
So do you think the reason for that was those sponsored ministers at that time? They had,
basically, I mean, yes.
They had the power to...
Well, not only the power...
Put together.
No, not only the power, but... when you haven't been accustomed to mass action, and they are, you see, your ministers are not people who go in for decisions on the part of people.
I don't know whether you realize it or not.
And
you see, they had been looked upon as saviors. And so what happens is, here they are faced with a suggestion that goes against the grain and for which they are not with which they are not prepared to deal. So they come together.
There's one other question I'm a little bright and forth. Namely, the question involving Dr. King, first year president of SCLC, and at the same time he was still president of MIA. And I'm wondering if that ever caused any friction or any...
Friction where?
On the part of the people in Montgomery, MIA people are trying to secure funds, and the SCLC people are trying to get funds. So it seems to me that Dr. King would have been the main instrument for both organizations in bringing funds for them to continue operating. So was there any problem in that regard, or is that personal?
I think your best person for focusing on that problem, if there were one, would be such as Nixon, because he was the treasurer and he resigned, and he resigned for certain reasons. But it wasn't so much the problem of, let's call it the dual function of King, because unfortunately, in retrospect, what you are seeing, you're looking in retrospect, but at the initial stages, you have to reckon with the fact that most of the people involved had never had any experience in developing mass action, and they function largely in the church vein, that if you had a meeting and you preached to the people, and the people would go out and do what you say do and come back, you see. So it wasn't a question of opening it up. It was largely ministers, and just about all ministers.
Well, Grandma Tilly was the first executive director of
FDLC. That's right.
Now, one of the persons contending for an executive director, according to the sources I looked at, was Reverend Martin Luther King Senior. You know, it was a constant thing of his. In each one of the few minutes I saw, and I haven't been able to see all of them, he would tell them, don't forget we've got to get an executive director. And, you know, you always kind of look for little nuances or things that give you some kind of a hint. And I got the impression now that he was hoping they would hurry to get somebody where he could take some of the pressure, the heat, off of his son. What's your thinking in that regard? Do you think that...
Well, it could well be, because I don't think at the stage even of the Montgomery bus boycott, Martin Luther King Sr. was ready for the role that Martin was catapulted into, and I use the term advisedly, because I don't think Martin Luther King Sr. nor Jr. had... thought in terms of juniors being in Montgomery in terms of developing a mass action program. You see, they were still ministers. And so he probably was thinking of an executive director to take some of the pressure that he conceived of it off of Martin, plus the fact the SCLC as such formally organized over a year before it had any office or any executive at all. How do you explain that?
Right, and how do you explain that in the middle of 1959 they reduced the executive staff to one, namely you?
Well, I was the one. See, I opened the office. I set up the office of SCLC. And that's the story I'll tell some other time, but I will not go into detail, because I went there primarily to their first program, which was to have 20-odd meetings in different cities simultaneously on the same night, which is February 12th. But I went there primarily to do to their first program, which was to have 20-odd meetings in different cities simultaneously on the same night, which is February 12th. Yes, and for both, and so I had anticipated being there about 6 weeks, give myself 4 weeks to get the thing going, and 2 weeks to clean it up. But they had nobody. And how did they get Reverend Tilley? See, they wanted a ministry. I knew that. They couldn't have tolerated a woman, and they couldn't have tolerated a woman.
Well, let me review something. I had occasion to look at the criteria for selection that was suggested by Dr. King and a couple of people to
when?
The selection committee.
When was the criteria, suggested?
Well, in 58.
That's
the difference. It was 58 prior to the time, and Dr. King emphasized that they shouldn't just confine that consideration to ministers, you know. And I thought it was kind of strange that he made that point, but I think that it was made advisedly in that he wanted to encourage bringing in people with a few more administrative skills than he believed ministers had, you know. And but anyway, they wound up getting Dr. Tilley. But as soon as Dr. Tilley resigned, you stepped in and became executive director. And from the sources I've seen, I also see where you conceived this idea of the citizenship crusade. And you spell out in detail some of the things you felt should be done. Did you encounter any difficulty in trying to get this problem over, or was FCLC glad to get it, this proposal?
Well, first place, Reverend Tilley became the executive, largely because I knew Tilley. They had, I knew they wanted a minister. See, Byatt was scheduled to go down even at the time I went instead of me. I hadn't thought of it. I never had anticipated to set up the office. And after setting up the office, and after the program of February the 12th had taken place, there became pressure from the people, the ministers who were involved, for an organization. The person whom you might talk to if you ever get around to it is a minister in Nashville, Smith, James Smith.
Kelly Miller Smith,
yes. Very perceptive young man at the time. And so when they hadn't found anybody, or at least they hadn't decided on, they thought in terms of the young man who's now dead, I think, who became president of Birmingham College, Pitts. Was a teacher in Georgia, and I had known him in my NAACP days. So I went to him and talked with him, and he asked me to talk with him. They had made some slight overtures to him, and then he decided he couldn't do that. So I suggested they had waited, gone around. Nothing was happening to me. Someday they'd see. What was happening was nothing, except what I was doing in the office there. And so I suggested, since they had to have a minister, there was, and I heard that Tilley had been responsible for a voter registration drive in Baltimore, which may or may not be quite accurate, because that was no doubt masterminded by the president of the Baltimore branch NHCP, Mrs. Jackson, and her daughter, Juanita, who was the wife of Clarence Mitchell, who was the NHCP Washington Bureau person. So anyhow, they never got around to calling anybody. So Stanley and I met Tilley here in New York. Tilley said he would be interested. And then he went down to see them. And he became the executive director. But he maintained his church connections in Baltimore, which meant he was in and out. So whatever was being done in terms of continuity has to be done by whoever was there, which is me.
These first 3 years of FCLC operation, 57 to 60, you were, if not an intimate participant, right there where you could see most of what was going on. So my question to you is just what was the role of the executive director of FCLC in contrast to the role of president of FCLC, Dr. King?
Different from the a role of a director in such organizations, NACP, CORE, and so forth. The executive director was more or less not under direction, but nominally under the direction. The personality that had to be played up was Dr. King. The other organizations, if you notice, the executive director was the spokesman. But you see, they couldn't tolerate having an old lady, even a lady, and an old lady at best. It was too much for the masculine and ministerial ego to have permitted that. And so... there you are.
You show great insight to me in this period. I've been looking over, you may call it hindsight, but it seems to me that you were up on what was going on. You made some recommendations to FCLC on some of the long-range things you felt they should do, and two things you felt they should do in particular, namely try to create a program where they could get more women involved in the movement, try to come up with some program to get more of the youth involved in the movement. This was before the Greensboro thing, and I regard this as being a great deal of insight. What was it you had seen which made you realize at that point in time that women and youth would eventually be playing vital roles, or they should be included at that point in time in trying to bring about whatever social change was taking place?
Well, I guess from my own experience, but basically, in terms of the church, all of the churches depended in terms of things taking place. It was women, not men. Men didn't do the things that had to be done. And you had a large number of women who were involved, say, in the bus boycott. And they were the people who kept the spirit going, you see. The young people. And then, of course, I knew that young people were the hope of any movement. And so it was just a normal thing to me. And ministers, you see, the average Baptist minister didn't really know organization. Now, this I know most people would be highly critical of, as they were. What happened was a minister would come into a church and he would follow the pattern that had been there all along. You'd have a Sunday school, a ladies' home, a ladies' auxiliary, and all this. All the change that he would do, all that he did was change the person who was in charge, you see. Yeah, it wasn't created. And
is there everything that happened in the latter 59 or 60 or whatever, which triggered the SCLC to start moving, really, using that state from 57 to 60 as an organizer, and, really to...
Well, what triggered it, it was the formation, the thing that maybe triggered it more than anything else to get into a broad program of action or effort for action, was the formation of the existence of SNCC. The sit-ins, out of the sit-ins, came SNCC. And SNCC was an actionist group, activist group. And have you read The Making of a Black Revolutionary by James Forman?
Yeah. Give you credit for bringing about two almost profound compromises
in terms of SNCC and SNCC's relationship to SCLC. The first one, and I'd like you to clear me up if I'm in error on that, took place in that second organizational meeting that they had. And no, the first one led to the actual calling of the meeting. You believe, and you express that in the papers I've seen, that in order to keep the spirits going among these young people, keep them from being discouraged and resort to violence, we better get them some kind of coordination and direction going right here in organization. So you talked the SCLC into underwriting this Raleigh conference at your former school there. And that's where you first got together, where you brought all these students in from North and South and some leaders. And the young people, from what I can gather, was a little skeptical about Dr. King at that time, but they were somewhat high on Reverend Lawson, you know. But they went along with adding nonviolence to their platform because of the influence of people like you and Reverend Lawson, in addition to the career of Dr. King. And the second one, where you brought about a compromise, is at Montego at the Highlander Folk School. And this one, I think, was a little more significant in that it almost led to the breaking up of SNCC. You had a group there that wanted to be engaged in military action, you know, confrontation, full throttle ahead. You had another group who had been enticed by the overtures to engage full force in voters' registration, you know. So you suggested that they go both ways. And the young people fought that, and they came away.
Well, what they really were fighting over was a question of dominance. You see, those who came out of the nonviolent resistance struggle, like Diane Nash and some who came out of Nashville, they were more deeply indoctrinated in the real philosophy and practice of nonviolence than many others. Those who were advocating voter registration had been influenced to a large extent by their meetings with such personalities as Bobby Kennedy. Bobby Kennedy had tried to almost buy them in terms of saying concentrate on getting black people registered. Of course, he had in mind the next election, which would have brought his brother back in, you see. And so at the Highlander meeting, there were those who contended very heavily for their point of view, to the point that they looked like they were splitting. And I have been accused by a couple of the grown-ups there of not letting them more or less split, because those who were very dedicated to the concept of nonviolence did not see that voter registration would precipitate a conflict, not a conflict, but a confrontation with violence. The nature of the kinds of areas into which they were going, because the young people decided after this was year, months and months, weeks and weeks, all night and so forth of discussion, they recognized that going to Southwest Georgia, going down into deep Alabama and Mississippi meant you were going to be faced with violence. And so, and they, so then, if they compromised, it was largely in terms of the fact that the strength of the movement lay in being together, not in division. That was the basis. Mine was not a choice of nonviolence versus
right.
But in mine was in terms of the history of the knowledge of history that I at least had, and the recognition that where their strength would ultimately lie would be in involving people in mass, but together,
right.
Not one fighting for nonviolence.
Right. Can I ask you this? What, during that time, what was the NAACP Corps' reaction to their CLC when they, you know, don't have time. You know, get the action.
Well, outwardly, it was friendly, let's put it that way. Maybe subterraneously, there were concerns about the extent to which FCLC might preempt their role in certain places. But no, you didn't have any outward conflict.
Your organization pulled an awful lot of people from the DNAC.
No, I don't think so. No, I don't think
it was because you didn't accept individual membership.
That was one of the basic.
That was one of the basic rules of SCLC in order to try and placate organizations like NAACP.
That was a basic projection from the beginning when those of us who talked in terms of organizing SCLC or some force in the South was to avoid individual memberships. Which would not place you in competition with the NAACP.
Well, Ms. Baker, your idea for Crusade for Citizenship did create somewhat of a problem. I'm mindful of the fact that you tried to get an advisory committee together for this thing, and you sent names out to all of the big people. Just so they would lend that name to it. You weren't asking them to really give money, but just to lend that name to it. Senator Rappaport and even Senator Roy Wilkins was. And Mr. Wilkins subsequently declined, but he recommended somebody from his group. But Mr. Park said explicitly that he didn't want to be involved with this citizenship project because he was already on the board of the NAACP, and they were engaged in similar action, and he didn't want the NAACP to feel that he was encouraging another organization that was doing basically the same thing that they were doing. And beyond that, there were reports in New York Amsterdam News and one or two other papers that Wilkins was a little peeved at this kind of thing. You know, they didn't state specifically what he said, but they got the implication that he was peeved. And obviously, Dr. King felt the same way because I remember in a memo that he wrote to the executive board that he was going to try once more to try and get cooperation between his organization and the NAACP. So can you shed any light on that situation for me, or did you detect any kind of antagonism or friction or tension between the two groups at that time?
Well, I think what you're faced with was a normal situation in the period, in the context of the period. Here was an organization that was in 1950, the NAACP was at least 41 years old. But I think it came into being 1909. It had carried on certain kinds of programs. And here was an individual who had not had any real connection, see, hadn't grown up in the struggle. Martin had not historically been a part of any part of the struggle. He was the son of a well-to-do minister, and he was in search of a higher status in terms of education. And I don't think there's any record of his being involved in movements of any kind prior to that. Yeah. So what do you have? Somebody could say there's an upstart. And I guess these are the human factors. So I'm sure there were strains. For instance, frequently Roy would have to be sort of convinced, let's say, to put it politely, to participate in such as the March on Washington and famous march. Prior to that, there were the 1957 prayer pilgrimage, and then there were a couple of marches involving students in terms of schools. The question of school segregation, but the mass action type thing like that, the NAACP at that stage had not been involved with. And naturally, there would be this sense of priority of rights, let's call it, And who was the bridge between that? That was Phil Randolph. You look at the record. Never did they have a conference in terms of working out without Phil Randolph. Phil had the respect of both. Phil had articulated the concept of mass action and had attempted, the thing that got called off.
March on Washington.
Yeah, March on Washington in the 40s. And Mrs. Roosevelt and Mayor LaGuardia, our good angels of the
liberal
angels, talked him out of it, you see. But NAACP could not afford, Roy could not afford to absolutely turn thumbs down on the situation because they could have been left out in the cold, number one. And number two, their deep respect for Phil Randolph.
He was really a monument in that scenario.
Yes.
Look at it, because he initiated the idea to go and talk to the president, the Secretary of Health here for instance, and he wanted to have a call-up meeting, but he wanted a forum.
Yes.
But Roy and Brains turned thumbs down on that. Now, they didn't go along with him on that. Martin Luther was wholeheartedly in favor of it. And other leaders, aside from themselves, coming in talking to the president, you know. But the Urban League and NAACP didn't think that would be the wisest thing.
Well, you see, they couldn't trust Core. In their mind, you see.
No, that's right.
See, what you have there is the division between those who have some respect for mass action and pressure and those who believe that your best result came from negotiations from the knowledgeable people, you see. And the negotiations from the knowledgeable and legal action were the NAACP and the Urban League.
There were four of the people who, four of the names that were frequent in this whole episode. And I'd like to mention them to you and just get you to give whatever response you can to them. I'll mention them and give you my impression of what they were doing. You had Stanley Levinson. From the time of his involvement in writing the book Stride Toward Freedom, clean on up until I have been able to see documents beyond the year of 62. The man was King's constant advisor. You know, he just revered in the man. You know, he just regarded King as being something super special, and he didn't charge him a penny for all of the legal work he did. Not in print. He told him that he did not want him to pay him anything. He was doing this because he wanted to participate in the movement, and this was one way he could try and look out for him, you know. And every important decision I think King made, he either consulted with Levinson or he got some advice from Levinson.
Where do you find this?
In the papers in Boston University.
King's papers.
King's papers.
I see.
And he put all up down there, King's papers. That man wrote him on everything, on his book, on his taxes, on his dealing with Fred Gray down in Alabama when Gray wanted to rip him off for so much money for representing him, on Ming out of Chicago. The whole episode, this man was giving King advice, and King seemed to have regarded his advice highly. So what was your impression of Stanley Levinson, number one? Another individual was Bear Rustin. Rustin gave him a great deal of advice. And there's something that's puzzling me in David Lewis's book. He mentioned that about the middle of 1959, King backed out in the last minute on his participation in the Southern Conference on Education Fund because he feared that he might be, you know, called a communist or being sympathetic toward communists. But at the same time, he was getting ready to make a recommendation to the board that they hire Bear Rustin as his special assistant. And there was already rumors out that Rustin might be associated or might have socialist and communist leanings. You know, so this is somewhat, I can't reconcile how on one hand he would just completely disassociate himself with Skeff,
And on the other hand, he's going to wholeheartedly endorse Rustin when he pointed out in his recommendation that he was mindful of the fact that this might be misinterpreted. People might attribute our going in different directions. But this, he felt that Rustin was so valuable to him that he had to take that chance. And one other person I want you to speak to is Smiley, Glenn Smiley.
Oh, Smiley.
Now, Mr. William Miller, who worked with FOR along with Smiley, wrote King around the middle of 1959. This is where all of this is coming ahead. But that, and suggested to him that there was some friction between Smiley and Rustin, and that both of them were trying to get his attention, you know. And King replied to him by saying that, yeah, he had been observing that for a number of months now, but he was at a loss to know exactly what to do about it. But there's no question about Smiley's commitment, you know, to the nonviolent principles and the fact that he was willing to give his all to SCLC and the cause of nonviolence. So these individuals, in addition to yourself, keep coming up.
And he was giving his call all not to SCLC, that was to the Montgomery Bus boycott.
Was he part of the SCLC?
Not that I know of.
Okay, very good.
No. You see, so what is your major question?
My major question is, how did you perceive being close to the whole movement, the role of these gentlemen? Was it similar to the one I portrayed? Do you see it differently?
No. Stanley, number one, comes out of the American Jewish Congress. He had some prior knowledge of the value of social action because the Congress was not just an organization of top heavy individuals alone. But you see, the Jewish people have been people who did a lot of demonstrating. And he was part, as I said, party to the initial discussions, thinking of how do you keep alive what has come out of what has been demonstrated in the Montgomery Bus Boycott. So you were raising the question of his dedication. He didn't have to charge because he had income, he had business, and he was knowledgeable about fundraising. And whatever his personal motivations for doing it, you would have to find out from him. But the fact that he was involved before in social action, see, I met Stanley when I was president of the local branch of the NAACP, and he called upon me for trying to get some action out of the NAACP against the McCarran-Walter Immigration Act. You see, many times there are other groups, especially in the New York area, that are much further advanced in terms of dealing with social issues that affect the whole population than the NAACP, which was concentrating primarily on race. So Stanley, I met, so when the boycott came about, he knew that Rustin came out of the Fellowship of Reconciliation way back, and at that time was with the War Resistance League. And he has a history of dedication to the concept of nonviolence. I have no such history. I have no such no such commitment in my historically, nor even now. Can I claim that? Because that's not my way of functioning. So here you are. You needed somebody who had the entree to nonviolence. You needed some, and there was another question, how do you pay for these things? So, that's explained.
Yeah.
I hope.
Well, it does. It goes a long way in explaining it, because Levinson was a contact
and the circles around New York and other places on the East Coast.
Sure.
Nobody could get money.
Sure.
And money was a vital ingredient for this whole thing.
Yeah.
And he also...
Welcome back. And that was an extensive interview, part of an extensive interview with Ella Baker, one of the legends within the civil rights and human rights movement in the United States. During that part of the interview, she discusses her involvement with the NAACP in the South. Also, she went on to talk about her interaction with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, her becoming the first executive secretary, and other issues. We'll take a break and we'll be back with more of our program for this week. And this is the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast. Welcome back, and that was Alice Clark with the track entitled Keep It Hid. Another pivotal figure in the civil rights struggle and other mass developments in the 1960s was Miss Fannie Lou Hamer from Sunflower County, Mississippi. This is taken from a documentary on Fannie Lou Hamer and her contributions to the struggle for voting rights, civil rights, and for self-organization.
We've been down so long, we ain't got no other way to go but up. icon of civil rights history tells her own story in words and song.
I question America. Is this America? The land of the free and the home of the brave.
If I hate you because you hate me, I'm no better than you are.
Fannie Lou Hamer's America. The following program contains mature content, including racial epithets used in historical context and descriptions of violence. Viewer discretion is advised.
The whole world is watching us today.
I am old pilgrim of sorrow.
We are sick and tired of being sick and tired.
I feel better than I felt in a long time. Cause all of these people here, we got to do something. And we've been down so long, we ain't got no other way to go but up.
It was 40 million of my people destroyed as they was bringing my ancestors here on the slave ships of Africa. I can forgive easily for a lot of things, but when white America taken my name, that was a crime.
My name is Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer.
I'm Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer.
One day you'll be proud when you can say, Senator Fannie Lou Hamer, because I'm on my way there. Yeah.
Freedom is not something that's put in your lap. You got to stand up.
Yeah. I've been beaten in jail till my body was hard as metal. But I'm not stopping.
The flag is drenched with our blood. Because, you see, we have never accepted slavery. They know what they've done to us. All across this country, they know what they've done to us.
I question America. Is this America? The land of the free and the home of the brave.
When and where were you born?
I was born 1917 in Montgomery County, October 6th.
You born on plantation?
I guess I was.
You know the name of the plantation?
No, I don't. I know my parents moved from Montgomery County when I was 2 years old and they moved to Sunflower County.
Going to the plantation then?
Yes, my parents moved on a plantation when I was 2. They moved with a landowner about 4.5 miles from here, almost to Judge Brandon's plantation. And that's where my father and my mother were the sharecroppers quite a long time.
Sheepie, were you little lamb way down in the valley? Woods and the butterflies picking at his eye, and the poor little thing he cried, Mama, Mama's gone, Papa's gone, they shall bring some horses, white and black, speckle and gray, all them pretty little horses. When you wake, you'll eat a pancake and ride a pretty little pony. Go to sleep, Go to sleep, little baby. Mama run away. Papa wouldn't stay. Left nobody but the baby.
We are tired. We are sick and tired of children suffering from malnutrition. People dying. The clothes 2/3 of the people have on here now is clothes was been sent to them. We are tired of it. We are tired. We are tired of a lot of things. We are tired of working for three measly dollars a day, going home and being too tired to cook what little we did have. Because we have been hungry. We have been taught to have dignity and respect. And you know if we are going through being bit by dogs, some of them being shot down, some of them being beat in jail, we are not fighting back, but we going on because there's nothing right here. What other nation have gone through what we've gone through? You've never heard of no other race but a Negro that marched through a mob crew just to go to school. Why? We work all time and never have enough food. I said, but the white man be riding around in fine car. I said, and they have plenty to eat. But I didn't realize at the time he was stealing it from me. Being one of 20 children, very poor family, sharecroppers in the state of Mississippi, I know what it's like to be hungry. I know what it's like to be without clothes. I know what it's like to be without food, to live in a three-room house with no washroom facilities, just a three-room shack. So in my earliest childhood, I remember one day I was playing beside this road and the landowner drove up and he asked me, could I pick cotton? And I told him I didn't know. I didn't know. At 6 years old, you know, I just didn't know. So he told me, I want you to go out in the field, Fanny, and I want you to pick 30 pounds of cotton. And if you pick 30 pounds of cotton in a week, I'll carry you to my commissary store, and I'll let you get some of the things that you want to eat. So don't you like Cracker Jack? That was exciting because I'd never had them. So I went out in the field, and I told my parents. And my mother asked me, did I want to try? And I told her I did. And she told me, said, now, we won't let you cheat. If you pick it, we'll say you pick it. But if you don't pick it, you don't get it. So this made me work very hard. But that week I did pick 30 pounds of cotton. That Saturday, the landowner did keep his promise. He carried me to this commissary store. He gave me some Cracker Jacks and cheese and the Daddy Wide Leg sardines. But I didn't realize what he was doing other than that, because the next week I was tasked 60 pounds of cotton. By the time I was 13 years old, I was picking 200 and 300 pounds of cotton.
I am 17 years old. I pick 300 pounds of cotton a day.
I am 9 years old. I help my mother pick cotton. I pick 100 by day.
I am 14 years old. Now I help my mother pick cotton. I can pick about 200 a day.
Now at first, I really couldn't understand what it was that made us never have enough food. We worked all the time, but we never had enough to eat. We never had a chance to go to school. So my first reaction to my parents, especially to my mother, was to raise the question to her and ask her, how come we wasn't white? Now that was my first really being told off and read off at the same time. Because my mother told me, the child, you don't understand what I'm saying now, but as you get older, you'll understand. There's nothing wrong with you being black. And I don't want you to forget that. That if you had, God had wanted you to be another color, you would have been another color. That don't be ashamed of being black. And respect yourself as a child. And as you get older, respect yourself as a black woman. You might not understand what I'm saying now, but one day you will understand. Then finally, my mother bought me the first black doll I had ever seen. But the only doll that she ever bought me was a black doll. And what my mother was doing, I couldn't understand it then, but I understand now. She was at that time teaching me to respect myself. My mother's mother had 23 children, 20 boys and 3 girls. She was a slave.
And we know, as well as you know, that this country was built on the blood and the sweat of black people. And all we are saying to you today, now what you have done in the past, you've done that. But we can't let you get away with just trying to wipe us out as human beings.
When I was about 13, I began to understand what my mother was talking about. And I prayed to God to give me the chance. And I told him if he would just let me live to get grown, I would get out in the streets and on the turn roads. And I would devote my life for seeing that things would be different for any poor person in the state of Mississippi. We have always been taught that we had to suffer as Christ suffered. But I think in terms of what David had to do, David was a shepherd boy, but it did come in a time in his life he had to slay Goliath.
Jump down, turn around, pick a bale of cotton. Jump down, turn around, pick a bale of day. Oh, Lord, I'll pick a bale of cotton. Oh, Lord, pick a bale of day. Jump down, turn around, pick a bale of cotton. Jump down, turn around, pick a bale of day. Jump down, turn around, pick a bale of cotton. Jump down, turn around, pick a bale of day. Oh, Lord, pick a bale of cotton. Oh, Lord, pick a bale of day.
So in 1962, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee came into Roosevelt. That Monday night, I went over here right around the corner here to this church, William Chapel. And the pastor announced at the end of service that there would be a mass meeting that night, that Monday night. My husband drove me from out in the rural area where I had been working to the church. And when we got there, Bob Moses, Lance Guyot, Reggie Robinson, James Bevel, Jim Foreman from SNCC got up and explained how it was our constitutional rights to register and vote and how it could change, you know, the different laws. Like if we didn't want a law in the town or what was going on, we could vote them out. So that, I thought it was the most remarkable thing that could happen in the state of Mississippi.
I'd never heard until 1962 that black people could register and vote.
I've never even heard that that was in the Constitution.
Well, we go in and live with people, live in their homes, trying to get them to the point where they lose some of their fears. We have to cut across generational fear.
I went to a SNCC conference in Nashville, Tennessee in November 1962. And the first time I had a chance to just sit next to a white person, I've never been that nervous in my life.
SNCC is the type of people, they call them far left, radicals, beatniks, and all of this kind of thing. But they still is willing to go into areas. They work with the people that's poor. They work with the people that never had a chance to be treated as a human being. And if it's necessary, some have already done that, has given their lives for the cause of human justice.
We would go to places to go in to do voter registration, and we'd talk to people, and we would tell them we was coming back the next day, and by the next day somebody would be done got to them, and they wouldn't want to talk with us. We would be harassed, and we know cars would be passing the house loaded with white men, and trucks would be passing there with guns hanging up in the back. Well, it was rough.
Year after year, things looked like it got worse and worse. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee helped to build confidence in people that they was just about to lose all hope. And that's the truth.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Citizens Council Forum. It's our very real pleasure to welcome back to our microphone today former Governor Ross Barnett of Mississippi.
Dick, it's been my pleasure to participate in your program several times, and I'd like to say that it's been my privilege to travel throughout the length and breadth of America during the last few years. One thing that has impressed itself upon me throughout my travels, and that is how similar the people of this great nation really are. No matter where they happen to live, they're all about the same.
I know that you were asked about the state of race relations in Mississippi at the present time. What was your answer to that question?
Well, they always ask that question about race relations, and I told them in substance that until all the communist-inspired agitation began, Mississippi actually enjoyed the best race relations of any other state in the nation. I told them that our white and colored citizens knew one another as individuals, and that they cared about one another as individuals. And despite all of the efforts to create ill will and hatred, that I honestly believe that on a person-to-person basis, that the people of Mississippi still have the most cordial race relations in the nation. And I told them that we are all going to try to keep it that way, both the white and the black. I told them that our voting qualification laws are sound, and they are, that they have been upheld by the federal courts time and time again, and there's no question about that. I told them that our registration officials understand that these laws must be administered fairly, with no one placed under any undue burden, that all are to be treated alike. I told them that the record will show no proof whatsoever that any qualified applicant in Mississippi has ever been actually denied registration because of his color or his race or national origin. But whatever mistakes have been made, if any have been made, probably were errors of judgment by part-time registrars. To put it in simple language, it is not that some qualified have been denied the right to vote. It is probably a matter of some perhaps unqualified white applicants who have been registered to vote.
I'll begin from the first beginning, August the 31st in 1962, that I traveled 26 miles to the county courthouse to try to register to become a first-class citizen. I was met by my children when I returned from the courthouse, and my girl and my husband's cousin told me that this man that we had worked for was raising a lot of cane. And about that time, the man walked up, Mr. Marlowe, and he said,
Is Fannie Lou back yet? So my husband said, she is. I walked out of the house at this time. He said, Fannie Lou said, you've been to the courthouse to try to register, and we are not ready for this in Mississippi. I said, well, I didn't register for you. I tried to register for myself. He said, we are not going to have this in Mississippi, and you will have to go down and withdraw. And he said, I'm looking for your answer, yay or nay. So I just looked. And he said, I'll give you to in the morning. And said, if you don't go down and withdraw, you will have to leave. And if you do go down and withdraw, it's on the how I feel. You still might have to go. So I left that same night. 10 days later, on the 10th of September, 16 bullets was fired into the home of Mr. and Mrs. Robert Tucker, the people that I had gone to live with.
I don't find that there is any great deal of intimidation. I'm sure that there is some intimidation. And I'm sure that that intimidation does exist in every state of the American Union.
My name is Charles McLaurin. I work in voter registration in Sunflower County. On January 25th, 1963, I went to the mayor's office in Indianola, Mississippi. The purpose was to see if there were any laws on the book that forbidded voter registration activities in the city. The mayor jumped from his seat and said, you black son of a bitch, don't you come in here arguing at me. I told him that we were there to do voter registration and that if there were any laws that forbidded it, to let me know. And he said no. I turned to walk away, and he called me back, said, go out and teach everybody in the town. I don't care. But if you go into any churches, I will cut off the tax exemption.
For instance, you had some 28 to 30,000 qualified in the state to participate in the last campaign for Congress, which took place just a few weeks ago. And of that 25 or 30,000 that could have participated, there were only about 4,500 votes that were cast. The trouble is that the it's like the white man, was not interested.
My name is Jesse Harrod, and I participate in voter registration in Mississippi Delta. It was during 1962, I was arrested in Jackson for contempt of court and fined $100 fine and 30 days in Hinds County Farm. The first time I was beaten was in Hinds County on the elevator when officers asked me my name and where I was from, and I told him I was from Jackson. And so he beat me and he hit me side the head in the back and things. The second time I was beaten on the Hinds County Farm because he asked me where was I was from also, and I told him Jackson. And he said, are you one of those freedom riders? And I told him I didn't know what it was, so he beat me.
We are not going to tolerate any group from the outside of Mississippi or from the inside of Mississippi to take the law into their own hands. We are going to see to it that law and order is maintained and maintained Mississippi style.
If I hate you because you hate me, I'm no better than you are. And all we want to do is to make these people understand that we are human beings and we can work together in this country. And to have a democracy, that's what we're going to have to do. And I think about the turmoil and the things that's going on across the country. And it carries me a lot.
Hello and thank you for joining us. I'm Wilson Stribling. Welcome to another edition of At Issue, where we discuss and debate the critical issues facing the state of Mississippi and how these issues impact you. Tonight, we take a look back at the life and legacy of a civil rights icon, Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer, who would have turned 100 years old on October 6th. She went from picking cotton in Sunflower County to commanding the nation's attention during the Civil Rights Movement. She helped organize Freedom Summer in Mississippi for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, also known as SNCC. She was also instrumental in the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party at the 1964 Democratic National Convention, where her testimony opened the country's eyes to the oppression of African Americans in Mississippi. Tonight, we'll hear from people who knew Mrs. Hamer, but first, we hear from historians at the Fannie Lou Hamer Institute for Citizenship and Democracy at Jackson State University, in their own words.
She was a sharecropper, and she was influenced by her mother and her father. She was also a biblical scholar, so she was really concerned about how can you provide relief for the oppressed people? How can you provide relief for the people who were mired in poverty? So she was concerned about those issues all of her life, and she often said that she didn't exactly know how to get involved in the movement, but she saw things that were happening across the country. So when the civil rights organizations came to her community, she immediately partook of their activities and got involved in the movement. So she grew up with an idea that she wanted to improve her life chances and the life chances of the people in her community. Her main role was that she was a civil rights worker. And so one of the primary responsibilities as a member of SNCC was voter registration. But she did more. She established Freedom Farm in Sunflower County. She fed people. She clothed people. She did those things that you are admonished to do, provide clothing and shelter. And she did that for her community in Ruleville, but also she helped people across the state of Mississippi and across the nation.
She endured violence and threats. And through it all, she kept her eyes on the prize. She kept hate out of her heart, and she challenged America to be a better nation.
The Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party in 1964 went to the Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City, New Jersey, and they challenged the lily white segregated delegation of Democrats from Mississippi. And we went there with the sole purpose of replacing the segregated delegation. And we made claim that we were the legitimate delegation that represented all segments of the population in Mississippi. And the segregationist delegation did not represent all segments of the population. So Mrs. Hamer and all of us were calling for that these Freedom Democrats should be seated and not the lily white segregated delegation from our state. I didn't have any idea that we would have such a national impact on the country. I didn't really have any idea that Mrs. Hamer, that her testimony would have such a national and international impact on the country.
And if the Freedom Democratic Party is not seated now, I question America.
It was overwhelming. It was emotional. It was uplifting. It was like being in church on a good Sunday. It was overwhelming.
Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our telephones off of the hook because our lives be threatened daily because we want to live as decent human beings in America?
Her testimony was just that influential. But her testimony helped to change the rules of the National Democratic Party. So in the future, the party promised not to seat segregated delegations. They agreed to have men and women, black and white, in the delegations. So Mrs. Hamer's testimony was able to accomplish all of that. Her 15 minutes of testimony helped to change the very foundation of Democratic Party and, by definition, Republican Party politics in America. And this was a woman with a sixth grade education.
So Fannie Lou Hamer is an extraordinarily important person. There's a reason that not many people know about her. It's because if we tell the story around Fannie Lou Hamer, we tell the story about a person who's not supposed to be an American hero. She's black. She's female. She was a sharecropper. Didn't have a formal education. If we tell a story of American history where someone like Fannie Lou Hamer changes America, then anyone can change America who's dedicated to it. And I think that we don't tell that story. That's not the story I learned growing up. And that's not really the story I learned in college. We studied leaders, and leaders looked like me. Leaders were had money. Leaders had education. Leaders went to private schools, you know. And Fannie Lou Hamer represents a kind of democratic hero that we still don't know how to incorporate in the history that we teach. And we would have we'd be a very different America if Fannie Lou Hamer was on the standardized test, you know, but she's not.
We can make this that she's known because she gave really nice speeches, because she mobilized people, because she organized, and all of that's very important. But she also helped change institutions. She also was a symbol representing a whole host of people who had not been heard politically. She can be also seen as a symbol of a whole host of people who currently aren't being heard politically and still need to have that kind of public voice and that kind of public presence. She could be seen as a reminder of what America actually is and what citizenry actually looks like. The willingness to engage your government, the willingness to challenge injustice, even at great personal cost. But I think it's really up to us as to how she's going to be remembered. Because unfortunately, she can also just quickly become a footnote to history, and that would be a shame.
Here's what Mississippi Congressman Benny Thompson says about Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer. Quote, Fannie Lou Hamer was a clarion voice in the fight for justice and equality. I was fortunate to be one of many civic-minded individuals who was touched by her passion and purpose. Mrs. Hamer used her voice as a weapon against injustice, and that legacy lives on today. Mississippi and this country are better places because Mrs. Hamer was willing to force the issue, even at the expense of making others uncomfortable. Joining us now are two veterans of the civil rights movement, both of whom knew Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer personally. Flonzie Brown Wright is a native of Canton, where in 1968 she became the state's first female African-American elected official since Reconstruction. She is an author, lecturer, and consultant. The Reverend Rims Barber is a Chicago native who came to Mississippi as a volunteer during the Freedom Summer of 1964, and he has been here almost ever since. He has spent the better part of his life fighting for stronger public policy for those most in need of a strong voice. And we thank you both for joining us on At Issue this evening.
Thank you.
I'd like to start by finding out a little bit more about how you got to know Mrs. Hamer. Ms. Wright, how did you first become associated with her?
Well, living in Canton, and of course, Mrs. Anna Devine was a co-worker of Mrs. Hamer. And I was Mrs. Devine's driver.
Oh.
So anytime Mrs. Devine had to go to Greenville to meetings with Mace and other political meetings and programs, I drove Mrs. Devine. So I knew of Mrs. Hamer before I met Mrs. Hamer. And on one of my trips to Greenville, there was a meeting with a group of individuals of which Mrs. Hamer was one. But I knew her, and I knew her. So when I actually met her, it was as though I had known her all the time. But I met her through Mrs. Annie Devine.
And was that before she rose to national prominence on the stage there at the Democratic National Convention in '64?
Well, it was during the time that they were planning that. I did not attend the '64 convention, but I raised funds to send people. But I knew of her work. I knew of the sharecropping issues. I knew of her attempt to register and vote and also assist others to register and vote as well. But I met her really in the planning phase of many of these activities.
Rims, how did you first come to know Fannie Lou Hamer?
Well, when I was working for the Delta Ministry up out of Greenville, we worked in Sunflower County as well as other counties, and she was instrumental in getting more voter registration going, and in 1967 getting people to run for public office for the first time with a chance to win. So I got to meet her then, you know, and I remember, you know, sitting in her carport on a stool shucking peas and talking politics that sort of thing as she was inspiring people to get out and vote that year.
And that's where it really all began for her, was when she attempted to register to vote, was it not?
Oh, yes. But that was a couple years earlier, mm-hmm. when she tried it in 62 or 3. and was thrown off the plantation and came then to live in the town of Ruleville. But she lost her job, her house, everything.
Just for attempting to register to vote. Yes. She was not successful that first time because of all the hoops that they made people like her go through.
Yeah.
Ms. Wright, what was it about her? There were lots of people involved in the movement back then. What was so different about Mrs. Hamer that propelled her into a leadership position to where ultimately she was there in front of the country?
Well, just listen to Mrs. Hamer. It was in her eyes. You could see almost through her eyes. She was committed, and even though she only had a sixth grade education, she knew the issues. She was a well-respected individual, so consequently, it was not difficult to get people to follow her, because here they see a woman who is making a sacrifice for so many to try and register, to try and get others to register, being thrown off the plantation, going to jail, being beaten, and never losing her sense of purpose. And so it wasn't a fly-by-night thing for her. She internalized the issues of registration and what she could do to encourage people and to educate people on not only the right to vote, but the importance of the right to vote. As you know, history teaches us in 1963, we conducted a mock election because we had not gained the right to vote at that time. So in 1963, during the gubernatorial race, we ran Aaron Henry for governor, which was also one of our colleagues, and Reverend Edwin King for lieutenant governor. And even though we knew our vote didn't count, because of her constancy and the dedication of so many others, the mock election resulted in 80,000 African Americans coming out in mock polling places across the state to vote for those two individuals. And even though it didn't count, but what it did, it showed us the power. It showed us that if our votes could count, the power that we had to change things, to effectuate change. So this was in 1963. And so following when we got the Civil Rights and the Voting Rights Acts passed, it let us know again that no longer could we sit idly by and allow people to make decisions for us, because it gave us the opportunity and the right to make decisions for ourselves. And Mrs. Hamer was a very, very instrumental part of that. And, of course, when those three women stepped out, and we just saw their pictures a few minutes ago, when they stepped out in Washington as a trio, everybody knew that these three women meant business, because our women had to cover and protect our brothers and our fathers, because they could not step out the way that they did because of economic catastrophes. So it was the women, and of course you probably are familiar with the film, Standing on My Sister's Shoulders, from which that clip was also included. But it was the women who really made the movement work. Mrs. Hamer was a singer, and of course she sang a lot of her pain away. Even when she was in jail and beaten by black prisoners from the back of the jail, you could hear her singing, "This Little Light of Mine." And everybody up and down the jail, the hallways of the jails, would join in singing that. Because, see, they can't take your singing from you. They can take your rights, if you will, but they cannot take that inner soul of you from you. And Mrs. Hamer exemplified the inner soul of an individual.
Rims, talk for me a little bit about the impact and the importance of her testimony at the 1964 convention, why that was so significant. She talked about what she had endured in the South as just a regular citizen of the South, what it was like for an African-American woman in the South back then, presumably to an audience that had not heard a lot of these stories before. Why was that so significant?
I think it was for the first time that many people came to understand what the dangers were. That, I mean, in those days, it was not just segregation. It was not just you couldn't use the drinking fountain or try on a pair of shoes before you bought them. It was real danger.
Ms. Wright, was that speech that she gave before the Credentials Committee, was that a turning point, not just in the committee structure or the convention structure, but also in the movement itself?
Absolutely, because, again, these women stood on principle, because they were offered two seats. two non-voting seats. They were offered two seats.
At large? Or yeah. And what was it she said? We didn't come all this way for no
two seats?
Seats.
Yeah. That was from Eunita Blackwell, because these women coalesced and got together and said, well, what must we do? And so Ms. Blackwell asked Mrs. Hamer, Mrs. Hamer, what are we going to do? And Mrs. Hamer say, we came here with nothing, and we're going to leave with nothing. We will not accept these two seats. Two seats do not represent the people that we have brought along with us. And so then the next year, 4 years later, then, of course, they were seated. But again, it took courage for these women and people to come together to try and make change. And, of course, we have now followed that through the first black president. And so actually the stance that they took then ultimately resulted in, some years later, America electing the first African-American president. So her impact and the power that she had years ago, we're still talking about her today, aren't we? We're talking about her when she's been dead 50 years, probably, and almost 100 years old. Yeah. And so this is the kind of impact that people's lives need to make. When you are serious about a commitment, you just can't do it because it's a popular thing to do. I've been to jail. I've been shot at. I've been tear gassed. I've had my life threatened and the lives of my children threatened because I was involved in the Madison County movement. And Reverend Barber knows that very, very well. But you see, you can't stop because the fear of death. And I knew at any point, just like her life could have been taken, so many other lives were taken, and so many other lives could have been taken. So we not only lived it, but Reverend Barber, we lived through it, and we lived to tell it. So we have to tell these stories. This is not something we do because people think it's a nice idea. We do it because we're committed to teaching our children and our grandchildren and this world about the sacrifices that people made, not necessarily black people, because Reverend Barber's been in jail more times than I can tell. But he never stopped because he was committed to a cause which was right, and it still is today.
Rims, Mrs. Hamer were still here today, if Fannie Lou Hamer were with us today, what do you think she would be most concerned about?
Well, I think that we'd be looking for, and we always are looking for, a new generation to come along and set the agenda. And some of the young people in Black Lives Matter are doing that, and I think that's important. And, you know, in 64, we were led by young people. I mean, Fonzie was a cute young lady then, back then.
Aren't you kind?
And still is, of course. But it was young people who really led things and made things happen. And that has to be today. I mean, Ms. Hamer would be looking for the young people to come forward and set the new agenda for today.
Ms. Wright, what do you think that Mrs. Hamer would be concerned about if she were with us today?
I think Mrs. Hamer would expect for those of us who live through it to continue to try and create teachable moments. In my capacity as an independent consultant, and I have an opportunity to teach and lecture students from junior high school, college, and university levels. And sometimes when I hear people talk about this, say, well, girl, I'm just sick and tired of being sick and tired. They don't even understand the genesis of that statement.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so I think we have to create teachable moments, because I was teaching a boot camp in Canton last year, and someone made that comment. I said, young man, I said, stand for me. I said, do you know where that comment came from? Well, I just heard somebody say it. I said, then let me teach you. I just so happened to have on my DVD player some clips of Mrs. Hamer, Mrs. Devine, and some others, and I put her face on the screen. And I said, do you know this? You know this lady? I've seen her face, and this is Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer, who actually coined that phrase. I'm just sick and tired of being sick and tired. And that's when you have gone as far as you can go, and you think that you can't go, as we say, another further, another day. Somehow something rises up inside of you and said, hey, you can make it. You've got to make it, because people are depending upon you to make it. So we have to create and find teachable moments so that our intergenerational group will know our history and their own history, and be in a position to carry that history on as well.
What do we know about the years between the convention in particular in 1964 and the time of her death, which was more than 10 years later? What did she do after sort of rising to that, I won't call it the pinnacle, but to the national spotlight?
Well, she concentrated on building up things in Sunflower County primarily. She had the Freedom Farm. She, you know, got people together to grow vegetables and to raise pigs so that they could have food. She worked to get people registered to vote across the state. She helped build up the party, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, and then in 68, combining and coalescing with the Loyalist Democrats to actually be seated at the Democratic Convention. So she was deeply involved in all that stuff. But she fought for the rights of people to not be hungry, to not be ignorant, you know, for the school systems to really respond to the needs of the children so that we could have a better community.
Mm-hmm. But do you think that she would be satisfied that we have come where we need to be in that regard, in Sunflower County, in any of the surrounding counties in that part of the state?
We have made so much progress that it's wonderful. But there are still gaps. Hundreds and thousands of people left behind for whom life has not changed, who are just as poor today as they were back then 50 years ago, who are living in hovels that you and I would not live in, which we would call uninhabitable, which are often defined as uninhabitable, but people are living in them. Housing is still a big problem in Mississippi. There are thousands of people who are hungry in Mississippi. There are other things that need to be changed. You know, we have some Medicaid issues to make sure that people get adequate health care that have to be addressed. We should have a change in the state flag so that it represents everyone. There are lots of things that could be done that I think Ms. Hamer would be on the front line fighting for.
Ms. Wright, what do you think she would think about Sunflower County and the surrounding area today?
Well, again, to your question, you see, Mrs. Hamer didn't realize that she was making the kind of history at that speech that she ultimately and consequently made. So she would continue on the path that she was on, as Reverend Barber says, voter registration. Even though we consider that speech to be the pinnacle, the apex of her life, that was one of many. The fact is she had a national and probably an international audience at that time, but she didn't see that as some great thing she was doing or saying. She just knew that she had to rise to the occasion. And the reason Mrs. Hamer was chosen between the three women, Mrs. Anna Devine was educated, as well as Mrs. Victoria Gray. But because Mrs. Hamer could command your attention with her voice, with her eyes, with her passion, she was chosen to speak before the Credentials Committee. But she didn't think she was doing something so ostentatious. She just knew that this was part of what she would do on a daily basis. And so on daily, her life continued on the path that she was already on, and which was continued voter registration. She ran for public office later on. Senate, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was continuing to not only run for office, but to encourage others to run for office. Because, see, once we got it, it took us a little while to get this voter registration thing. It took us a while. But once we got it, once we understood that we could command change just by getting the right to vote, can you imagine going to the registrar's office and being given a 2-page, 21-item questionnaire asking you how many bubbles in a bar of soap, how many feathers are on a chicken, and how many jelly beans in a pound of candy? Are you a communist? Just to register and vote? And so these were the kinds of things she would have continued to work on even at 100 years old.
Hmm.
She would have been telling us, man, look, y'all babies, y'all go out there and look. You know, Mama Fanny Lou got to them. Look, y'all got to go out there and fix that stuff. So that's what she would still be doing. She would, in a wheelchair or a cane, y'all take me out here to this rally and just let me just sing a little song, this little light of mine. Because it was in her. And see, once it's in you, once you get it, you cannot pretend that you didn't get it. And so Mrs. Hammond would still be continuing in the way that she possibly could to enlighten, encourage, and educate our people as to the kinds of challenges that we have had to overcome, and not let those things slip away that are continuously, little by little, being taken away. And so she would say, y'all rise up now. Y'all got to get up. Get up. Rise up.
Flonsie Brown Wright, Reverend Rims Barber, thank you both very much for your time on Ed Issue this evening.
And thank you.
Thank you.
We are out of time. Don't forget, you can watch the program on our website, mpbonline.org/issue, and we invite you to join us again next Friday night here on MPB for another edition of Ad Issue. Good night.
Louisville, but also she helped people across the state of Mississippi and across the nation.
She endured violence and threats, and through it all, she kept her eyes on the prize. She kept hate out of her heart, and she challenged America to be a better nation.
The Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party in 1964 went to the Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City, New Jersey, and they challenged the Lily White segregated delegation of Democrats from Mississippi. And we went to the movement. So she grew up with an idea that she wanted to improve her life chances and the life chances of the people in her community. Her main role was that she was a civil rights worker. And so one of the primary responsibilities as a member of SNCC was voter registration, but she did more. She established Freedom Farm in Sunflower County. She fed people, she clothed people, she did those things that you are admonished to do, provide clothing and shelter, and she did that for her community. And
Violent Coordinating Committee, also known as SNCC. She was also instrumental in the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party at the 1964 Democratic National Convention, where her testimony opened the country's eyes to the oppression of African Americans in Mississippi. Tonight, we'll hear from people who knew Mrs. Hamer, but first, we hear from historians at the Fannie Lou Hamer Institute for Citizenship and Democracy at Jackson State University, in their own words.
She was a sharecropper, and she was influenced by her mother and her father. She was also a biblical scholar, so she was really concerned about how can you provide relief for the oppressed people. How can you provide relief for the people who were mired in poverty? So she was concerned about those issues all of her life. And she often said that she didn't exactly know how to get involved in the movement, but she saw things that were happening across the country. So when the civil rights organizations came to her community, she immediately partook of their activities and got involved in.
Hello and thank you for joining us. I'm Wilson Stribling. Welcome to another edition of At Issue, where we discuss and debate the critical issues facing the state of Mississippi and how these issues impact you. Tonight, we take a look back at the life and legacy of a civil rights icon, Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer, who would have turned 100 years old on October 6th. She went from picking cotton in Sunflower County to commanding the nation's attention during the civil rights movement. She helped organize Freedom Summer in Mississippi for the student nonviolent.
Welcome back, and that was two clips from two different documentaries on the lifetimes and contributions of Miss Fannie Lou Hamer. That's going to conclude our program for today. You've been listening to the Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast for Sunday, March 17th, 2024. We've been broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. If you'd like to have access to this program, go to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. If you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, go to our website at pan-africannews.blogspot.com. That's pan-africannews.blogspot.com. We're going to close out with the music of Max Roach and Abby Lincoln from the Freedom Now suite, We Insist. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.
Driver man, he made a life, but the mammy ain't his wife. Chopping cotton, don't be slow. Better finish out your row. Keep a moving with that plow. Driver man'll show you how. Get to work and root that stump. Driver man'll make you jump. Better make your hammer ring. Driver man'll start to swing. Ain't but two things on my mind. Driver man and quitting time.
Happy just to die. Run away and you'll be found.
by his big old red bone house. Paddy Roller, bring you back. Make you sorry you is black. Drive a man he made a life, but a mammy ain't his wife. Ain't but two things on my mind. Drive a man and quittin' time. Lying, can it really be? Can conceive it, can believe it, but that's what they say. Slave no longer, this is freedom day. Freedom day, freedom day. Throw those shackling chains away. Everybody that I see, they
slave no longer, this is Freedom Day. Freedom Day, it's Freedom Day. Throw those shackles and chains away. Everybody that I see says it's really true, we're free. Freedom Day, it's Freedom Day. Free to vote and earn my pay. Dim my past and hide away. But we've made it Freedom Day.
Yeah.